In 2024, 299.4 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance and protection. Preventing, mitigating, and responding to humanitarian crises is a challenge. Can fiction and storytelling play a role? Can it raise awareness and motivate action to address the causes and consequences of humanitarian crises? My name is Ruth Mukwana, and I host the Saha Pod, Stories and Humanitarian Action, where I discuss this question with humanitarian practitioners and writers. Welcome to Saha Podcast, Stories and Humanitarian Action. As always, I have a great guest for you today, but before I introduce her, I'd like to ask you to subscribe to my YouTube channel. And if you enjoy today's conversation, please like, comment, and share it. My guest today is Megan Koheny Galbraith, who is a writer, visual artist, and an adoptee. She's the founder of the Never Hush Workshops for Adoptees. Her debut hybrid memoir in essays, The Guild of the Infant Savior, an adapted child's memory book, was published by Mud Creek Books, Ohio State University Press, in May 2021. Her work was notable in Best American Essays 2021 and 2017, and she's the director of the Bennington Writing Seminars. Welcome to the show today, Megan.
Thanks, Ruth. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate you reading my book.
Now, of course, and as we were talking a bit earlier, I am very excited to talk about the book for you. And as I also mentioned, I normally talk about fiction, but when I read your book, which is really speaking about your experience being adopted, it also, you know, talks about abortion, which is really a huge topic on many of our minds today with what happened last year. Yeah. I really wanted to have a conversation with you.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, the book takes place because I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm a 1966. I was born in 1966, which was before Roe v. Wade was a law. And so abortion was not legal. And here we are years later, and it's illegal again. I feel like we're going back in time. And I think with a lot of the debate that has been gone on recently, especially with the Supreme Court justices, specifically Amy Coney Barrett, being adopters, adoptive parents themselves, you're hearing rhetoric that includes things like, you know, adoption is an option, an alternative to abortion. And this is just cognitive dissonance. This is not... It fails to listen to adoptee voices, because if you talk to adoptees, especially, you'll hear that there's the trauma that is induced by being taken from your mother as a child. Some people have said an infant suffers from being permanently separated from their mother. They consider it to be more severe trauma than a veteran returning from war. And those traumas, for a war veteran, they know something before the trauma happened. But for an infant, let's say for adoptees, they call it the primal wound. So being taken from your mother is when you're pre-verbal. So you wind up spending your life, like an adoptee can wind up spending their life in just a state of survival. And also, you know, another thing to note, their adoptees are 4 times as likely to attempt suicide. And so having, I think, adoptee rights, just as women's rights or human rights, and this culture of adoption as an alternative to abortion, I mean, underscores a cultural history of like taking babies from women and coercing women to give up their babies. And a lot of babies being forcibly taken from their mothers. You know, this week alone, we had an apology from Scotland's like minister, Nicola Sturgeon, to thousands of unmarried mothers who were coerced or forced to give up their babies in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And you see this time and again now, as people are reckoning with the effects of adoption and the effects of, I mean, it's child stealing in many ways, and it's human trafficking if you really want to put words on it. Is at its base, it's human trafficking because you're exchanging babies for money.
Yeah. And no, and you know, we've just really gone straight into it. But again, you know, I mean, to me, the notion that adoption is a solution to abortion, I wonder, even just, you know, thinking about the experience of the children themselves, but also of the mothers,
yeah,
giving up children. I don't know. I haven't gone through that experience, but I'm a mother myself. I can't imagine how difficult a decision that is. But also often, there's so many people, and probably because you've been, you know, you're working on this, you've researched a lot on it, there's so many of these mothers don't even have the choice about giving up their babies.
Yeah. I think the a lot of stories that, a lot of, not stories, narratives that I've heard include things like, you know, women being asked to sign papers that they thought were medical papers, but they're actually relinquishment papers. I mean, there's a huge cultural history of babies being like forcibly taken. The indigenous people, like, are the United States took babies. Their interest is in separating mother and baby, which is interesting because that's not the rhetoric that comes from the right. They blame it on the mother. And statistically, mothers, unwed mothers, people in this situation don't want to give up their children. The issue is poverty and lack of support services. And, you know, instead of thinking of what can we do for the mother to keep families intact, it becomes, let's take a baby from a mother and transplant them into a different home. And it could be for transracial or transnational adoptees, that could mean, you know, erasure of their culture, erasure of language, you know, being they're thrown into this, I call it the adoption diaspora, because they don't, you don't know where you live. You don't know where your home is. And all the self-help stuff that's like, oh, your home is within you. I mean, talk to any adoptee who's kind of reckoned with these things and they'll be like, that's a great platitude, but what does that mean for me? So it's just, the more I researched, well, in researching this book and my next book, the more I'm like, oh my God, we're in back into the 19th century again with policies for about women and women's bodies. There's no bodily autonomy. And I just think, why empowering women and families should truly doing that is, you know, it's not much of a societal stretch.
No, honestly, it's actually, I was talking a few weeks ago to one of our gender advisors at work. And I often feel there is just this specific focus on really controlling women, women's rights and what we can do that is really out there in the, you know, policymaking world that kind of just never goes away. It feels to me, no matter what we know, you know, no matter that we know much better now today about, you know, everyone's rights, women's rights, and the fact, you know, I mean, for centuries we've been saying, you know, we've been talking about equality, you know, and yet there is still this, what I really call to me, obsession with wanting to control women.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I wish I knew. Sometimes I think, you know, is it a threat for someone? I was actually talking to one of my younger colleagues. I started to feel old. And she was saying to me, you know, things have changed from where where they used to be, and comparatively, they've changed for women, and depending where you were as well. But at the same time, I feel they really haven't.
Yeah.
When you're looking at the big questions, and to me, overturning, again, I'm not an American, but as a woman, overturning, you know, Roe word was such a huge shock to me. And I remember really feeling like, what is going on? Are we like just going backwards?
Yeah.
And for me, really fundamentally, it's a lot about choice. How do we make it so that everyone has a choice to make the right decision for themselves?
For themselves. Yeah. Yeah, it's terrifying how what, for me, what I thought was so written in stone, that I thought was a right that I would not have to. I have two sons and a stepdaughter. You know, I thought this was a right that we would have, that never was going to be questioned. And to have this shown in such fragility, like this, and to collapse the way it has, you know, and you're seeing things like maternal mortality is increasing now because of various legislations. Hospitals are sometimes saying, we're not even going to deliver babies anymore because the political atmosphere is so bad. So again, it's going to be these policies that are born, in my opinion, of on the backs of women and like shame and piety. And these policymakers, instead of keeping families intact like they say they want to, are instead ripping families apart. And it's a form of eugenics in some ways. You know, you're ripping a family from a mother to give to another mother, usually more wealthy, usually white. You know, this is with and adoptive parents like that, as you see, like recently with Colin Kaepernick, with his new book and talking about sort of the racism he endured from his white adoptive parents, the backlash when we speak out, adoptees speak out about their feelings about adoption is harsh. You know, it's like, be quiet, stay silent, be, you know, it's the savior complex. Like you should be grateful. You should be grateful. And, you know, if you think about that, like I have two sisters, one of whom is adopted and another is biological. And, you know, nobody says to the biological sister, oh, you should be grateful for your parent being a parent, like, you know, for having a house over your head, for your parent just doing the work of being a parent. So it's just, it's tragic. And I think these families by design, whose design is this, you know? Whose design is this when it comes at the expense of mother and baby?
And I also feel that, you know, because I've always felt like, you know, yeah, if we care about children so much, why is it only about legislating abortion? And because I feel like we are not putting as much time as I'd like us to in actually looking after these children once they are here in the world. If you look at the number of homeless children across the world, if you look at the number of children held up in conflict situations, if you look at the number of children being trafficked, and I often feel like, why don't we put more energy actually?
Yeah, into helping. I know. And it's, I haven't done enough research to speak so forcibly on this, but there seems to, like, in the 19th century, there were these agencies that were beginning to form to feasibly like help women and babies. But then there was like this rift, I think it was based in religion. There was like a rift that started shaming women for having unwed pregnancies, you know, instead of changing the narrative. It's like when you talk culturally about rape, it's always about with me, with women, for example, it's like, oh, don't go out running in the dark. Don't wear a ponytail because you can get, yeah. Instead, we're not saying to like our boys or to men, like, don't rape.
Yeah.
How about that? Like, don't rape women.
Yeah. No, there was, it's quite an important point because there was also like experiences where women are raped and then they are asked, oh, what were you wearing?
Yeah.
Or why did you go to that house? You know, why you're like, actually, that is really not the right question.
Yeah. Or now, like, you know, in the incidence of rape, women will have to carry that baby. And, you know, will she likely be coerced to give it away? Like, that baby is going to grow up with multiple trauma, you know. But lack of bodily autonomy, lack of choice with our, about our bodies is just, it, I mean, it's the thing that keeps me up at night, you know, thinking my daughter-in-law is pregnant again, you know. What choices is she going to have? Like, if she wanted to give birth at home, what, you know,
No, and I honestly, I had a friend of mine, I have a very good friend of mine who, she has two girls. I have a girl myself, and I really wanted a girl child. But when she found out she was pregnant with a girl, she really, really cried for so long.
Oh, that's terrible.
And I was like, why? She's like, have you seen how women are treated in the world?
Yeah.
And I remember going like, oh my goodness, how can it be that someone is afraid of what their girl child is going to face? Because she was like, the world is just made up, you know, for men today. And I just think, you know, all of the things that my daughter is going to go through.
Yeah. But maybe she'll change it. Maybe they'll be the agents of change, which is hard to put on a child. But I just, I don't know. Something has to change. More women should be judges. Right. Seems like all this is being legislated. So we need more female judges in positions of authority. Oh, God.
Yeah. But so your book, I know we got into the topics quite immediately. But,
sorry.
No, that's all right. going back to that guy, the Guild of the Infant Savior, what was the writing process like for you?
Well, it happened over a long time. I mean, I basically wrote this at Bennington. This was my thesis and came out, put it down for a while, wrote a bunch of other essays, and then incorporating the artwork was something that was interesting and came at a later date. I had gone to a residency, Saltonstall, the Saltonstall Foundation, and I brought my dollhouse with me as kind of a security blanket. I like to teach about the idea of play to free up your mind, to free you up on the page. So I had this tin dollhouse and just was staging fun scenes in it. And then one day went to the Cornell Library and found out about this program called Domestic Economics that was happening at Cornell started in 1919, that used live babies as what they called practice babies for women to kind of practice at motherhood. And it was so bizarre to me, like seeing this through my lens as an adoptee, that this could actually, it didn't age well, let's just put it that way. But so the writing process became visual at that point, because I started restaging these archival images in my book, using the dolls in the dollhouse, and then being able to see those in parallel with each other and stepping back and saying, wait, what am I really doing here? I'm playing at motherhood also, right? I'm recreating these domestic tasks that, like, in putting the art to work together, I was using, like, I do found objects, and I would use the sewing kit that I found in the bedside table to sew the images on pieces of paper and just hang them on little tiny paper clips in my studio. I was like, wait, I'm doing, yeah, these are domestic female tasks. I'm sewing things. I'm hanging these like diapers on this. And so then that's where I started questioning through my writing. Like the art came first and then the writing happened in that case. And I want to cultivate that more in other ways and like writing forward in my new book and writing in general, because it just opened me up to some things, especially the dystopian nature of adoption, because these babies were sort of fatted and raised as, you know, little incubator type babies and then adopted. So their identity, a lot of them didn't even know they were babies. They all shared the same name, Domicon, which was short for domestic economics. And so a program that was like quite feminist for its time was just so incredibly bizarre to me. And like I said, through my lens as an adoptee, I was like, this is not right. There was a lot of talk in the archives about, like in the files in the archives, about it being a feminist program and cutting edge and teaching women all the things they need to know for to prepare them for, you know, for motherhood and life, which is similar to what you're hearing now. It's like women should be home and should be mothers, you know, and that's what they should be preparing for. So the writing came together in a number of ways, like in these very hybrid ways. And yeah, and then I began staging this as like an adopted child's baby book by using my own baby book, which was called An Adopted Child's Baby Book, and curating photos, original photos from there, and restaging them in the dollhouse. So what you see is like a narrative over a narrative. You know, it's like the visual image of the dollhouse that fronts most of the essays, and then the little kind of curatorial archive, which is the actual photos of me at the end of each essay. And I like how it came all together. It was unexpected, but I really kind of love it. And I love those babies. I love my little doll babies.
No, and thank you for sharing this as well. It's a very creative process in terms of how you structured your memoir. It's art, it's narrative, you know, it's doing so many things from a creative perspective as well, which is quite amazing. Actually, congratulations for achieving that. And the essay you're talking about is Hold Me Like a Baby.
Yeah.
Which I would really recommend for anyone listening to this conversation to read, because if there's anything that's really going to make you stop and really think about what we are doing as humans sometimes, it is one of those essays. At least for me, I was just blown away by it. And maybe, I know we want to talk a little bit more about it. It does bring out so many issues. Of course, the idea that you can kind of manufacture, for lack of a better word, a perfect baby. And really the notion of really any of us saying this is a perfect baby is quite frightening.
Right? And the time, I mean, this was, let's say, when in parallel, when I was adopted, a lot of the same principles they used for these Domicon babies, like a very severe schedule of feeding. And, you know, I have in the book a schedule for one of the Domicon babies, and it's like 7:15 bottle, 7:30 urination, 7:45, you know, it's just like the idea that babies are robots. But on the other end, the parents who were adopting them thought, oh, these babies are being raised by scientific principles, and therefore they're the perfect children. And I think in many ways, my experience as an adoptee was similar. I came home with my adoptive parents with a note that had a similar list of what to do with me, like how to feed me, what to do. And I think there's an objectification of adoptees, of any baby, of any child. You know, it's like look at this, look at what we did, look at how amazing, you know, we are. And it was just very bizarre feeling. And so you have this narrative of you have to be perfect or potentially be sent back to, you know, sent back to wherever. And even though that might not be a reality, it's still sort of an embedded belief because it's that trauma belief. It's that abandonment complex that all adoptees live with, whether they recognize it, you know, and think about it or not.
No, absolutely. And I've actually read stories of people returning babies back, yes. You know, because they're sick or, you know, for whatever reason. So it actually, I mean, I don't know what the statistics are, but it does happen. But also just the pressure on parents to, you know, what is a perfect baby, honestly?
Right. I know. You know? I know. And like with any baby who does, like, adoptees come with a set of pre-wired, you know, things that adoptive parents are never, at least mine in the 60s, I'm sure they weren't, the caseworkers were not talking about things like abandonment issues or what. These are things that we've come to now after realizing like what the issues really are. So you could have adopted a baby who is like cries incessantly. You don't know why, you don't know how to soothe that baby. You know, and so there's the tension there. My mom used to say, and I'm sure she didn't mean anything by it, but like, I just want everything to be perfect. I want, you know, which I internalize as like, I need to be perfect, right? And this is something, it's not just adoptees, but there's the added layer of all of the trauma that makes it even a more layered, you know. Like, oh God, perfection is what I need. That's why we're overachievers. That's why we're type A's. That's why, yeah.
And you also speak to, which comes up a lot for many mothers as well. Like, I'm trying to see if I can find, because I scribbled it down, but almost everything that goes wrong with a child is the parent, the mother, you know, the mother is blamed, you know, for anything that goes wrong. And then you also were speaking a little bit earlier about it before the we started, you know, our recording, but how the early experiences of all of us right from infancy really informed the trajectory of our lives. And I think in there you talk about this research around the different types of attachments that can be taken all the way back to, you know, when we are still infants, so being, you know, secure, anxious, and avoidant, and how that early interaction with mothers is extremely important for you know, our growth. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this paradox of policymaking, of anything about women that glorifies motherhood but demonizes the mother. And I feel like that's how policy is made. You know, it's always the mother's fault. A mother who's unwed, or the baby's illegitimate. You know, the nature of the language that we use to describe these things is just way off base. Well, I forgot. What was the second? What was the last part of your question? Paradox of motherhood.
No, that's okay. It was more the early interactions.
Oh, the attachment. Yeah. Oh. Boy, I went deep into attachment disorder because I just, as a late in life, getting therapy from a real adoption-centered therapist, adoption-trained therapist, she introduced me to all these things. She's like, have you ever heard of Harlow's monkeys? And I was, absolutely not. So those were like original studies that talked about attachment. There are these, have you heard of these? Oh, it's so severe. They put infant monkeys in cages with wire mothers. One was wrapped in terry cloth, the other was wire. So there's nothing for the babies to cling on to. And then they just watch them. And the infants with the wire mother would just scream and sometimes like pull their hair out and try to. So it was like this idea that a baby needs its mother, even if it's a wire replica with, you know, wrapped in terry cloth to cling to. And that was sort of the basis of what launched attachment studies. And there's a lot written about them now. I'm watching this great show on TV with Kerry Washington. It's called Unprisoned. And she is a therapist and she's talking all about this. She was in foster care. Her character was in foster care for a long time. She has these attachment issues. She talks about it in this show in such a great way. And I'm like, yeah, I wish more people would know about those things, because knowing your attachment style is very much like the 21st century version of like Myers-Briggs these days. You know? It's like, if you can know that, you can know how to move around in the world. At least I'm getting used to it, you know, as like an anxiously attached person, putting words to what that means now explains a lot of behavioral things that that I did, you know.
No, I mean, I read about the monkeys in your essay, but I had never heard about it. And again, I was really, really, really struck by that.
Yeah.
But also very struck by, you know, the importance of how infants pretty much are treated at birth, and how that really, you know, informs some of the challenges that, you know, as adults,
yeah,
we end up struggling with, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And the process of writing a memoir, and I think I've said this to you before, I have so much admiration for all of you that are writing memoirs, that are sharing your stories, so much admiration for you. But one of the questions I had for you about that is, how do you do this? You know, because it's memory. How reliable is memory? It's truth. And you know, how do you go about all of these questions? You know, you're dealing with memory, of course, you're doing research, you're talking to people.
Yeah.
And how much of is it true? And these kinds of questions that I imagine writing memoir.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think it's what I hope that the meta narrative of the book is a questioning of memory as a coping mechanism. I think, and I've heard this from other people, there, you know, everybody, like Joan Didion says, you tell yourself stories in order to live. My birth mother had what I call a cocktail party story about me, you know, and that was a story she could live with. And then the stories she told me, it's just like oral history passed down, you know, it, you bury the things that you don't want as part of the narrative going forward, and you you get things wrong because people remember things incorrectly. So this, it's like this idea of family lore being passed down. And in some societies, let's say with the Roma people in Hungary, which I found out I'm Hungarian, so I got really interested in the Roma people. And their whole idea of storytelling is a way of keeping them safe, their communities safe. If outsiders come in, they tell stories that are partly fictional, maybe it has some truth in them. That's why, and this is a slur, gypsies are known stereotypically as like liars and cheaters and whatnot, because what they're doing is actually forming a narrative that is protective. And I think with adoption, there's a lot of protection narratives also. That's why adoptive parents don't like when we might speak out about our feelings about being adopted, because their narrative is like, but we rescued you, or we love you. It's like, well, I'm not questioning your love for me. I know that, like, but I can also, like, I can hold both things in my hands at the same time. I can not love the idea of being adopted and having to deal with these feelings, but know that you love me, you know?
Yeah. Oh, wow. And I mean, I think linked to that as well, I don't know if it's you who said it or one of the other writers of memoir, you know, as families, you know, but even as humans anyway, you know, even when we are in the same experience, at the same time, we experience it differently mm-hmm. and remember it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, you know, and I know you've also had to deal with a lot of backlash, and I'm going to ask about that because I think people who are interested in writing memoir as well, this is one of the things I imagine they have to be ready to experience. But what has that been like for you? You know, when you have a memory and you experienced it, whether with your mom or your dad or your siblings, and they remember it differently, and then they question, you know, your memory or your own story about it. Have you experienced that? And
oh, yeah. I mean, my family, this whole book, let's say my sisters, questioned everything about it, even memories where, and again, I think this goes back to sort of ego and the own the narrative you're telling yourself, but they would question even memories that I wrote about that I'm like, but you weren't even there. Like, but they feel ownership to question all that. First, they feel ownership to question my feelings, you know, and that's what, as a memoirist, I tried to do as much as possible is write about my feelings and not, you know, not like this is my memory and it is true. It is my truth. But here are my feelings and I'm struggling to figure those out in the context of my own memory, through the lens of time too. Like this is adult me looking back on child me with, you know, all I know now and all I didn't know then. But you know, my mother is not alive. My dad called it a betrayal. And I think for memoirists, and we hear a lot of people who want to write a memoir, and they're like, well, I'll write this when everyone's dead. And it's understandable because you have to have an immensely thick skin. But also in the time between when this book was published and all that I've overcome to get to this point, thanks to the backlash, I realize, you know, my voice is powerful and I deserve a place, you know, I deserve to speak also. And I think part of the tragedy of my family reacting the way they did is like, they've always done this. And I finally had to reckon with, oh, this has always been the way in the family. It's like, this is nothing really new, but now I'm seeing it as like for what it really is. And I think for me, that's the great tragedy. And, you know, it's like I have now a friend family who, you know, I have a dear friend who I call my sister, you know, I call my cousin my sister. And I'm just sorry that memoirists have to deal with it because people react from their ego, from a place of ego rather than understanding.
And what I really liked, I mean, I'm so glad you wrote it. And I know we're also coming down to our time, so I'm going to try and start wrapping up. But one of the things to me, and I'll again ask for your perspectives on it as well, is that I just learned so much reading your experience, your feelings. But I also know you did a lot of research, but really just understanding what that has been for you. And in that, for me, also just a bit more understanding, being more empathetic to others who may be sharing that experience. And so, you know, for me, I'm just glad that, you know, you wrote it, and thank you for sharing your story. But a related question to this as well is that, Are there things you feel the memoir, or nonfiction for that matter, does very well as a narrative form?
That memoir does as a narrative form?
Yeah. Like, if you think about the reason I ask the question, because I normally ask people, like, okay, you know, do you think fiction has power to, you know, address the causes and consequences of humanitarian crisis? But I was very much compelled to really speak to you about your memoir. And I'm just curious, like, what is that, you know, memoir or nonfiction, what can it do to drive change?
Yeah. Well, just like any other marginalized voice, adoptee voices are marginalized. And the more we can hear about our experience, the more it becomes a narrative that can be heard. So let's say my friend Nicole Chung, she has a second book out now about adoption. She's a transracial adoptee. And I just think of her as like a superhero, because she is making adoptee voices heard. She's supporting adoptee voices in this whole idea. So that's what I think. And with anybody who is writing from a place of marginalization, their voice needs to be heard and their art needs to be seen. And only then can we kind of reckon with what has been done.
Right. And my final question for you is, for anyone who will listen to this conversation, if there's anything, any action that they can take, what could that be that could really help or make a change?
Yeah. I think, well, of course, educating yourself about adoptee rights, reading more adoptee voices, definitely. Becoming aware of the culture of adoption. There's a Supreme Court case called Burkeen versus Howland, and it's a white couple who's trying to keep a native baby, and when that baby is welcomed back by its relatives and its tribe, and this is like in support, like this is challenging the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act. So like, this is not adoption, even though it's based in whiteness, it's not. It's read other voices, like understand what's still going on. You know, donate money to the ICWA so they can help, so they can fight this.
Thank you so much for your time, Megan, today.
Thank you, Ruth. Thanks. It's so nice to be here.
Thank you for listening to my conversation with Megan today. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please like, comment, share, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. I'd like to thank Melika Mensah, my co-producer, and the Nomadic Band for the music. Thank you.